Hi, I'm Brennan Trollinger for Optometry Times, and this is 10 questions for Benjamin S. Chudner, OD, FAAO, Vice President Eye Care, Chief Medical Officer of Acuity Eye Care Group in Dallas, Texas. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, just north of Los Angeles, so Van Nuys, California.
What did your parents do?
My mom was a stay-at-home mom for most of my life, then eventually went to work for a small company as a receptionist, and my dad was a headhunter, so he found jobs for people, mainly in the programming field. So he got into it real early in the late 70s, back when programming was not what it is today. So his job was finding people jobs, temporary jobs, actually temp placements in as programmers for various companies.
How did you get started speaking about optometric learning and development when you left optometry school?
That was actually by accident. That's a long story. I actually didn't start out right after optometry school. So after optometry school, I did a residency at Bascom-Palmer in ocular disease and thought that that's going to be my career. I was going to be this medical-based optometrist. And I went to go work for an ophthalmology group outside of Seattle in a very small town called Paulsboro, Washington. I did that for a couple of years and then had the opportunity to actually purchase a practice. And so I bought a practice in one town over was the owner and president of this fairly decent sized practice in another small town called Bremerton, Washington, very big naval town. And that practice kind of opened up a lot of opportunities. I met some amazing people who became mentors to me, and one of them was a guy who was a very large SEBA dailies prescriber. And we got to know each other pretty well through a study group that we participated in. And he introduced me to the world of lecturing on contact lenses. And so I did that for a long time. So starting in about 2003, I was lecturing for SEBA at the time before they became Alcon. On daily disposables, back when daily disposables were a very small fraction of the modalities being sold in the U.S. So we did that for a while, and that opened up doors with other companies like Bausch & Lomb and eventually some pharmaceutical companies. And I was doing quite a few lectures on practice management and contact lenses, and then practice management on certain things like dry eye. Back then, dry eye was not what it is today. We were talking about azacite and really Restasis was really all we were doing. But that really eventually got me an opportunity to come inside and work for Bausch & Lomb. And in 2008, Bausch & Lomb asked me to come inside as director of professional strategy. And from the time they offered me the job to the time I took the job, they were bought by Warburg Pincus, which is a private equity group, the president of the company was asked to retire. And within 5 weeks of me actually starting the job, my boss was asked to leave. About a week or two later, I was asked to leave. And so luckily I hadn't sold my practice. I went back to practice after commuting really every week to Rochester from Seattle. I went back to practice for a couple of years, had some life events that made me rethink what I wanted to do. And decided I was going to sell my practice and go back to work for Bausch & Lomb if they'd have me. And the only position they had available for me was learning and development. So I kind of fell into it really by accident, but I found it fascinating. And coming from someone who was speaking quite a bit, doing a lot of dinner meetings, I did anywhere from 30 to 60 dinner meetings a year, to see the other side of it, how decks were built and kind of adult learning theory. And, you know, going to different kind of continuing education classes where we discussed, you know, not disease or how to manage patients, but really how to talk to people and how to design PowerPoint decks and learning classes in a different way was fascinating to me. So I did that for a couple of years and I really enjoyed it.
What specifically drew you into and then away from private practice?
You know, I wanted to be an optometrist from a very early age. By the time I was in high school, my prescription was about a minus 850. And so I had been in and out of optometry offices since the age of five. And I remember in high school, we took a class, a career class, as you're trying to decide what you want to do with your life. And my dad actually suggested I look at ophthalmology just because I was kind of fascinated with the eyes at the time. And really, medicine didn't interest me as much as I wasn't so sure I would be all that excited about blood. And so I tweaked it a little bit instead of ophthalmology, and I looked at optometry and started researching it. So I actually went into undergrad as a bio major with the intent of going to optometry school. So I knew, you know, that's what I was going to do. I always wanted to be in private practice. I think that's true of most people going into optometry, is they have this vision of being in private practice and doing that for the rest of their lives. So that was always my dream. After owning a practice for about 7 years, when I got asked to come into B&L, it was a difficult decision. And I remember having a drink at the meeting that I was actually offered the job to with area sales director at B&L. And we were talking about it. He knew I was offered the job, and he said, what are you hesitating for? And I said, I asked him, will I still be an optometrist? If I'm not seeing patients anymore, I've identified myself as an optometrist for so long, and even before then, that I wanted to be an optometrist. Would I still be an optometrist if I wasn't in practice? And he looked at me and said, don't be an idiot. You know, if this thing fails, you can always go back and practice. And so I made the decision. And what I found is, once your mind switches, and my mind switched, and I left practice and I started enjoying other aspects and of what this profession can offer. Being involved in industry and having meetings with other doctors and helping them, you know, build their careers and get better at fitting contact lenses and really managing the contact lens business. And my mind just shifted. So when I got let go of B&L and I had to go back into practice, it was actually hard. I thought that'd be easy to do. You know, I was an optometrist, right? But it was actually pretty difficult to get back into practice, to get my mindset back into the day-to-day, seeing patients, managing my staff. And I found after about 2 years, I was no longer enjoying that. I wanted to get back to what I was doing before. So that's really how the switch happened.
Was there any one particular thing that, you know, during that made you go, wait, I am still an optometrist, even if I do this? I mean, was there a specific moment?
Actually, there wasn't a specific moment. I think what ends up happening over time, you're still talking to doctors, you're referred to as an optometrist. All the people at B&L would call you Dr. Chudner, or call me Dr. Chudner. And I think, you know, it just reinforced that, yes, I still was an optometrist, and I still was taking CE courses, and I was still doing presentations to other doctors. So over time, you just start to realize you'll never not be an optometrist. We call it a very small, big industry. So we all kind of know each other. I think it just, over time, you realize that's just who I am. I'm an optometrist, and it didn't matter anymore. But to go back to practice now, I don't know that I would enjoy it. I enjoy actually popping into a clinic, and I've had the opportunity to still see some patients with no pressure at all. And I actually rather like that quite a bit. But going back into do a day-to-day practice is not something I think that I would want to do.
How are private equity offers perceived now in optometry?
You know, I think it's a mixed bag, and it's actually changing rapidly as we start to see new people enter the marketplace. I think at first, when it was first happening, and My Eye Doctor really was probably the most well-known, I think there was a lot of curiosity and not really understanding what was going to happen. And then as they got bigger and bigger, I think fear starts to set in, and people were scared about where this is headed. I think now, I think fear is probably overtaking more than anything else, with VSP Ventures getting involved, because no one knows what to think of that yet. I don't know that VSP Ventures knows what to think of themselves yet, what they're going to be as they enter into this space. I think there's still a lot of people that do look at this as an opportunity, as an exit strategy for them. But I think there's plenty of doctors out there that have no, you know, that are very pro optometric profession and have a lot of passion for what we do, which I think is fantastic, that are really fearful as to what this means long term.
One thought that occurs to me is that, you know, I'm in Iowa, and in many instances we have small, you know, optometric practices, and where you're going to have retiring ODs who are going to be hoping that they'll be private equity company will come through that area, but you know, they may not not. And there's also the notion that maybe they want to pass on their practice to someone else.
You know, again, I don't have a crystal ball, but I think that, you know, there's always going to be a place for those that don't want to sell to private equity, that want to pass their practice on either to a buyer or a child, you know, that goes into the profession. I think that will always exist. I mean, people can sell to whoever they want to sell to. I think that in more rural areas, that'll probably be more likely the way things will go, only because rural areas are probably tougher for us, and it's harder for us to find doctors that want to go to those areas when the retiring doctor eventually leaves, or the selling doctor eventually retires. But who knows what'll happen in 5 years from now as all the practices that are desirable get purchased, if they can get purchased. I mean, so it's a weird crossroads that we're really in optometry now. You've got a lot of doctors that have built successful practices that think they're worth a lot of money, and they may very well be. And you have a lot of younger optometrists coming out of school these days with a lot of debt. I mean, we're hearing numbers. The latest number we heard from the Association of Schools and Colleges of Optometry was the average debt, not everybody has debt, but the average debt of those that do is $174,000 when they leave optometry school. And that could include some undergrad debt, but we've heard as high as $250,000 to $300,000 in debt. It makes it very difficult for these younger optometrists to then go ahead and buy a business that may be worth $1 million or $2 million. Very, very difficult.
I'll confess, I've spied on your Facebook posts. So why a baseball stadium tour?
Well, that goes back to moving my kids when they were younger. That's a great question. So when I moved from our place outside of Seattle all the way across the country to Rochester, which my wife and I are both from California. So even living in the Seattle area was different for us. But moving to Rochester was really different. My daughter was 9 and my son was 5 at the time. And my son was fine. He was, you know, he's 4. It wasn't that big of a deal. But my 9-year-old daughter, it was really difficult for her to leave her friends. And she had a pretty strong community. She was very active with soccer and had a lot of friends through that. And it was going to be difficult for her. She was just starting gymnastics, so she was getting into that. So the deal I made with her was, you know, look, we're going to be in New York. We won't be that far from New York City, although we're actually quite far from New York City.
Comparatively.
Yeah, 350 miles. But comparatively, we were, you know, 90% closer. So I said, what we'll do is you and I, was every once a year, we'll take the train into the city and we'll see a Broadway show. And that, you know, made her feel better about the move. She still hated me for the move, but made her feel better about the move. And we did that. So, you know, we take the train. It's about a 7-hour train ride. The good news is there's internet on it. So she was on Netflix and I was doing work, and we would talk and she would sleep. And, you know, while I was working around conference calls, and we go see a show, we'd spend a night or two in Times Square at the Marriott Marquis, which she loves. And we'd go to a really nice steak restaurant, and her and I, we'd dress up, you know, like we're going to a play, and we'd go see a Broadway show. So when my son got a little bit older, my wife said, okay, that's great. You're doing it with your daughter. What are you going to do with your son? And so I've always wanted to do a baseball stadium tour. I'm a baseball fan, and I've always wanted to do it. And I said, you know what? I'll do a baseball stadium tour with him. And so sure enough, she said, that's great. It took a while for me to get going. And actually, it took her finally saying, you know what? We're going to be her and my daughter were going to be out of town. So why don't you take them up to see Toronto play? And Toronto was playing the Yankees. It was actually during the pennant race towards the end of the season that year. And so we drove up to Toronto, got tickets, and we had a great time. And that was the beginning of it. So now, as of now, I think we're at 16 stadiums out of the 30. So it's been a lot of fun.
What's something your colleagues don't know about you?
Wow. I'm a pretty open book. I don't know that I have anything that interesting. My colleagues don't know about me. Well, I used to be an avid bowler and carried about just under a 200 average. That may be something people don't know about me.
How long did you bowl?
Well, I started bowling in junior high, took a break for a while, and then started up again after optometry school. So I bowled through high school and then took a break for college. Actually, that's not true. I took a bowling class in college for 0.2 credits. And then and then started up again when I got back, when I started practicing, and was on a league for 7 or 8 years. And then when I moved here to New York, some guys at Bausch & Lomb were bowlers as well. So I connected with them and were bowling. And then I haven't, unfortunately, ever since I left BNL, I haven't bowled. So I can't imagine what my bowling is like now.
Were you on a high school team?
No, I was in a league, but not for the high school. I don't even know if our high school had, I don't know if they had a bowling team. Probably a good thing they didn't. It was geeky enough to be a bowler in high school on a league. To be on the high school bowling team might have been pretty interesting.
Okay, you have lived all over the West, the Northwest, and traveled throughout the U.S., and now you're in upstate New York and touring baseball stadiums. So what is your guilty pleasure food?
Guilty pleasure food. You know what? I really love stadium hot dogs.
I was going to guess that.
I don't know if it's because I go to a lot of stadiums or I go to a lot of stadiums because of that, but there is nothing better than and my favorite is the Dodger dog. So, you know, the big foot long, I mean, they're huge, right? And with mustard, ketchup, relish, and onions, there's nothing better than that. That with a soda, but I gave up soda about 4 years ago. So I don't drink soda anymore, but that with a soda was heaven. So I don't do the soda anymore. It's usually with a bottle of water.
So what is it about the baseball stadium hot dog? Versus getting one from a grocery store.
Yeah, you know, it's just I don't know how to explain it. Maybe it's the atmosphere too. I mean, baseball to me is magical. And I remember my son and I were at the Dodger game, and this was just classic baseball. And I think maybe it's the whole experience, right? So you're there with people you don't know, but you're still, we cheer the home team unless they play the Mariners, because we're Mariners fans. Mm-hmm. So we cheer for the home team unless they play the Mariners, and we'll cheer the Mariners. Or when we went to Yankee Stadium, because we hate the Yankees. So those are the rules. So you're with we're at Dodger Stadium, and every baseball stadium, he gets a baseball that we put in a little cube, you know, has the logo on it, and he gets a hat. And so we're wearing Dodger hats. We actually were there. My family still lives in L.A., so all of my family ended up going to the game with us, but they were up in like the 300 level, and my brother-in-law had a friend who had tickets behind home plate. So we're about 7 rows behind home plate, just off center looking down the right field line. And like Tommy Lasorda was, you know, down in front. We could see him. He left early. We had to see him and, you know, say hi to him. But it was the Dodgers-Giants game. It was a big game. You know, it's obviously cross-state rivalry. And it was, you know, Giants went up 1-0. The Dodgers tied it. And I think it got to 2-2. Went to the 12th inning. It was the bottom of the 12th. It's two outs. There's a man on first, I think, maybe first and second. And this kid, Farmer, Chris, I think it was Chris Farmer. Farmer? He's not with them anymore. I think he's with the Phillies. He was called up that weekend. It was a Monday night game. He had been called up on Friday from the minor leagues. And his parents ended up staying the weekend in the hopes that he'd get in the game. And he hadn't gotten in the game yet. So this game, he gets up. It's bottom of the 12th, two outs. And he hits this ball right down, and we can watch the whole thing, right down the right field line. It's hooking foul, but it hooks away from the right fielder, lands fair. He gets a double, man scores, walk-off double, and the entire Dodger bullpen or Dodger dugout rushed him at second base. They ripped his clothes apart, throwing water. And I turned to my son, I said, you're never going to see, you know, and this is baseball. I mean, this is what it's all about, but you're never going to see anything like this again, probably in all the games we go to. This is like a once-in-a-lifetime thing for us. But that whole experience, people say smokers, I've never smoked, but they say smokers, a lot of it's the social interaction that they get, not just the smoking, but it's, you know, it's the hand, but being in the social setting and being with other smokers. So maybe that's maybe that's what it is for me. It's the whole experience of eating the dog outside, watching baseball when magical things can happen. So I don't know. I don't know how else to explain it. It just tastes better that way. To be fair, even watching my son's baseball games now, those hot dogs are pretty good too. And they're the same hot dogs I can get, you know, and I can grill up. In fact, I've worked at their concession stand before.
Okay, so who are you favoring in the series this year? You said that you're not going to root for the Yankees.
I'm not going to root for the Yankees. So we obviously want to see Houston make it.
Mm-hmm.
This one's tough because the Nationals have never been. Yeah. So it's kind of exciting to see that. But we're kind of AL West people. So, even though there are rivals now that they're in the AL West, the Astros, it would be exciting to see them win. And we kind of stick with, the AL West. But there is something cool about the Nationals never being there before. But we have a lot of businesses in Houston, and some of our doctors have connections to the game. So I actually – or to the team. So I'm hoping at least the Astros make it. They can beat the Yankees, and then maybe I'll get to go to a World Series game, which is a bucket list thing for me. I've never actually been to a World Series game.
What do you like best about what you do right now?
I do a lot of different things. My job is really two main phases. The first one is helping doctors make that transition from being an owner of a business to being an employee. So we help them through the process of really, do they want to make this decision for their practice? What does it mean? And what happens in the future, which is kind of cool. Which I do enjoy. It helps because we're helping a lot of people, I think. I mean, I wouldn't do it otherwise, but there are a lot of doctors that are looking for a transition from owning a business and really having a good exit strategy and really a wealth management platform. And they need a strategy to sell their business in a way that's very profitable for them. And they can take care of them and their family, for the rest of their lives. That part's really cool. But on the other side, I'm on the operations team. So my job is to help these practices grow, be more efficient, add more optometric services, expand on what the practices have done well, change the things they haven't done well. And I really do enjoy that. And that goes back to my days when I was consulting for the companies and B&L and SIB at the time, eventually Alcon and Allergan, and working with doctors to help them do better at their business. So I kind of really enjoy it. Everything that I do, it's a lot of fun.
What's your biggest frustration with optometry?
This one's a dangerous question. I think optometrists tend to be very slow to change their habits and are very short-sighted, myopic, if you would. And I think that's the biggest frustration is how short-sighted and slow to change optometrists are.
It's just being cautious, then.
No, I think, there's a lot of examples. Mm-hmm. I think you look at a private equity is definitely one of them. I think doctors that are they get very emotional quickly and they get fearful about it and they are unwilling to really hear about things. But telemedicine is another example of just this short-sightedness of optometrists. I don't know what will happen with telemedicine, but I do know that optometry has an opportunity. And telemedicine is going to happen. It can happen either to optometry or with optometry. And the problem is we're trying to fight it because we think it's not good yet. But that argument is not going to hold for a while. So, we're just, as a profession, very short-sighted. It's awful now. You can't get a good refraction and it's not a health exam. So therefore all telemedicine must be bad. The problem is people are doing actually some very amazing things to make telemedicine with an optometry very possible. And unless we as a profession choose to at least figure out a way to help shape the direction it's going, it's going to happen without us and we're going to end up being very unhappy.
Where do you see yourself in 10 years?
Wow. Well, I have no idea, actually. this is probably not a career-ending job for me. I doubt I'll retire from this role. We'll get sold at some point, as all private equity does, and hopefully we'll get sold multiple times. That would be nice. But I don't see myself retiring. So I think the job will eventually no longer be available to me and I'll have to go out and find something else. I don't know what that is. I may get back into consulting, probably won't be in practice. That's for sure. But hopefully I think ideally I'd love to be in some sort of a global role with a company and again, helping move optometry forward.
Do you have any regrets?
I do, actually. Professionally, I do regret when I bought my practice. The man I bought my practice from was an amazing optometrist and an even better business person. And I was so gung-ho to take over that I didn't listen to him enough. And if I knew then, as you know, it sounds so trite, but if I knew then what I know now, my practice probably would have been at least 50 to 80% even bigger than what it was, minimum. And I would have probably been able to sold the private equity for a lot more than I sold my practice for. But I do regret, he's unfortunately no longer alive, but I do regret not taking advantage of his expertise, because he was extremely willing and he was very supportive of me, and I he did consult me, but I really did not take advantage of his knowledge as much as I should have. And looking back now, I'd be far more ahead of where I am today if had I really listened to him more than I did.
Well, what's one piece of advice that he gave you that you either value or still needles you?
Well, so nothing he gave me needles me, because okay. He didn't give me enough because
well,
I didn't ask.
Maybe resonate may be the better phrase.
He strongly believed in empowering staff to make the right decisions for the practice. That was one of the things that resonates with me most. And he would always say that policies are put in place to allow the staff to say no. And that is the absolute wrong way to approach customer service. And it's dramatic. It's true today. I mean, I see it all the time where people fall back on the policy. I'm sorry, I can't do that. That's the policy. And what we did change, or he helped us work through, was how do we empower the staff to do what's right? And you know, probably the simplest advice that he gave within that context was just have the staff treat the patient or solve the problem in the way the patient would want to be solved. So we'd always have the staff ask themselves, if this happened to you, what would you want to be done? And almost always when we did that, the patient would want far less than what we would think they would want. And it would be worth it and would create such goodwill. But he just had a way. He built this business up in an area that really wasn't growing. You know, it was a military town, so it grew with the military, but also, you know, declined with the military. And he was able to grow a very, very successful business because he got it. And he was a very intelligent man.
I'll have to remember that line that policies engender no, because yeah. It seems to apply to so many things.
It does. It gives you license to say no, and we should be finding ways to say yes.
Okay, last question. We inflict this one on everybody. What's the craziest thing you've ever done?
Oh, I can't. I don't think I can say that publicly. what can I say that won't get me in a lot of trouble? The craziest thing. Okay. This is bad, but not as bad. So in college, I was in a fraternity. Mm-hmm. We had an annual party called the Islander. The fraternity was Phi Gamma Delta, and their nickname was Fiji. So we had a party theme that was an Islander theme. And so we had a new transfer student from the University of British Columbia and in Vancouver, and the Canadian chapter was just crazy. And so he had this idea. I went to UC Irvine down in Orange County, and back then it was a much smaller school than it is today, but it was centered around a park. Irvine was built as a reaction to the Berkeley riots, honestly. It was built in the 60s and it was built around the park. So the only place you could gather as a group was in the park, and you could be easily surrounded by the police. And so it was called Aldridge Park. It was actually named for the first dean of the college, who eventually was initiated by our chapter. He was in a fraternity that was taken over by our fraternity. And when he retired as dean, as chancellor, he agreed to be initiated by our chapter. So it was Aldridge Park. And so we would spend the up to 2 weeks before the Islander event, we would beat drums in the middle of the park to get people excited. That was not the crazy thing. We thought it would be a really cool idea to paint our feet purple and run through the campus with purple feet, paint on our feet. So there'd be purple footprints everywhere, getting everyone excited about the Islander. The problem was the guy who picked up, he's actually my best friend, he's best man at my wedding. I love this guy. The guy who picked up the paint didn't understand the difference between water soluble and water based paint. So it's, 11 o'clock at night. We've got pickup trucks and we're sitting in pickup trucks with paint, buckets of paint and our bare feet. We're dipping in, we're running around, and some idiots went up into the newest building, the science lecture hall. And eventually security was called and they chased us and eventually caught some of us. I was not caught, luckily, but some of the guys got back. My best friend got caught with purple paint. It turned out the next, that weekend was the time when all the incoming students would come with their parents. And we had littered the entire campus with purple footprints, including the brand new student center. Nothing on carpet or anything, but, the brand new student center. So the school was understandably upset that when they were going to have a fresh new group of potential freshmen and their parents coming to visit the school, and it would be graffiti, basically, with purple footprints all over the campus. So I got to campus the next day and it had rained overnight. I knew I was in trouble when there was a puddle on the ground, and in the puddle was a footprint. Half of it was in the puddle, half of it wasn't. And half that was in the puddle was not dissolving at all. So myself and about 20 others, we got the option. We could either clean it up ourselves or we could pay the school to clean it up, which was going to cost like $50 an hour. And they estimated it was going to be like 100 hours or something. And maybe it was $50 a person. It was going to take 10 people, 50 hours. I don't know. So the whole next night I was on my hands and knees with bleach and a scrub brush, scrubbing purple footprints off of at night. We couldn't even see them all as someone went behind us with a pressure washer. That was probably the craziest thing I ever did. Luckily I never got in trouble for it. Who knows what, I think the statute of limitations probably weren't, is gone, but, my buddy got put on, you've heard of from Animal House, double secret probation. Mm-hmm. He was actually put on social probation. So if he got in trouble doing some other prank, he would have been kicked out of school. But yeah.
Wow. Well, you paid your penance by grubbing all that stuff.
Yes. Oh yeah. It was a very long night the next night, and not nearly as fun as putting the purple footprints down. Let me tell you.
Well, Ben, it's been absolutely great talking with you today. Thanks for taking the time and being able to accommodate me on this.
No, my pleasure. Thank you so much.